This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Coming up on today's show, the Colorado End of Life Options Act, or Proposition 106. It's on the November 8th ballot in Colorado as an initiated state statute. In Colorado, aiding another person in ending his or her life is a crime of felony manslaughter currently. Proposition 106 would permit terminally ill patients with under 6 months to live to self-administer aid in dying drugs to voluntarily die. It would also allow a physician to prescribe the lethal drug to a terminally ill patient under certain conditions. In addition, Prop 106 would criminalize coercing a patient with a terminal illness to request the drug. Additional specifications on the measure can be found at ballotpedia.org. We'll have a link on our website. My guest today, Rabbi David Siegel. He's the rabbi of the Aspen Jewish Congregation. Randy Lowenthal is a proponent of Proposition 106, and Carrie Ann Lucas is an opponent. She's with the organization Not Dead Yet Colorado. I asked Carrie Ann and Randy to tell me how they got involved in the campaign.
I really came at this position because of my own personal experience being devalued by the medical establishment and watching the lives of my children, who also were all individuals with various disabilities, and watched their lives be devalued by the medical establishment. And just very concerned about the way that people fear the death of disabled people, even when we're not nearing death, when we're not actively dying. And I find I have grave concerns with that.
Randy.
I became involved a few months ago when I found out that there were circulating petitions for signatures after having lost a daughter, a husband, a father, and almost my mother. I've had a lot of time to think about death and end of life, and it's very important to me to have a personal choice about myself. So I jumped into the campaign.
David, as a rabbi here, I'm going to ask you to represent the faith community. It's not quite fair to ask you to speak broadly, so broadly for everyone, but it's something that, as a rabbi, you help people deal with frequently, I'm sure.
I certainly think about these issues a lot and work with people who are faced with it on somewhat regular basis, whether it's people facing it themselves or, as Randy spoke about, family members going through it. But I'll try to be vague and noncommittal when I talk about the rest of the faith community. But I can speak maybe to some of what could be considered religious values in play in this conversation.
I did some research in preparation for this, looking at Oregon and how it's worked out for them. Insofar as when Colorado legalized marijuana, many, many, many of the prescriptions in Colorado are being written by a small percentage of doctors. So there are weed doctors out there. And what we're wondering is, does Oregon have a similar effect in that there are only a few doctors who are becoming quote unquote death doctors? And could you speak to that, Randy? And then Carrie Ann, I'd like your input on that too.
First of all, let's understand that the Oregon Act has been in place since 1998. So we're talking about almost 20 years. And they run annual statistics, and they have tight reporting. So there's lots of experience that Colorado and the other states that are considering this type of thing, a lot of information that they have on past experience in Oregon. And they do believe, or the statistics do reflect, that there are, in fact, only a handful of doctors who actually do this. And if I can throw a statistic out, which really surprised me greatly, was that since 1998, only 1,500 plus prescriptions have been written since 98 to 2015. And of that, less than 1,000 actually took the medications.
In the 20 years or so?
In the almost 20 years that the Oregon Act has been out there. So it's not something that everybody's jumping to. It's not something that a whole bunch of people moved to Oregon to try to take advantage of, apparently, and that there are not whole lot of physicians within the medical community in the state of Oregon who have jumped on this also.
Does that concern you?
Well, frankly, it does concern me a great deal that there are only a few physicians that are prescribing these drugs, mostly because the safeguards are, frankly, inadequate to prevent people from doctor shopping. In theory, the safeguards should prevent somebody who has, say, depression or some other sort of mental health condition or incompetence to make a life and death decision, such as asking for a lethal prescription, asking for assisted suicide. And the concern is that when somebody can just simply doctor shop, as what happened with Kate Cheney, who's an individual in Oregon, whose physician who knew her thought she did not have the capacity to make the request for assisted suicide. And instead, she was able to doctor shop around it, and that's what people do, is they can just dip doctor shop around the safeguard. And so that's a concern. Even the very first known assisted suicide death in Oregon was a woman in her mid-80s who'd been battling breast cancer for over 20 years. And initially, two doctors, including her own physician, believed that her request was due to depression, and they refused to provide the lethal drugs. But instead, she contacted Compassion and Choice, as primary proponents of this initiative, and they referred her to another doctor willing to write the prescription.
In Colorado, in this proposal, there are some safeguards, and it does talk about, and I don't know, Carolyn, how much specifics you want to go into this, but there are two physicians required. There's an attending who is a physician who's to be diagnosing and taking care of a person who has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and there's a consulting physician who has to confirm the diagnosis. So from the very beginning, they were fairly sensitive to this, and it's modeled similarly to the Oregon law. And then it goes on from there about the physicians being required to have patients have an informed decision, which there's a whole very technical area about that, and that if there is any question about mental health, that a mental health evaluation is required, that the physician has a private consultation. So there's lots of opportunities for physicians to get into this with the individual.
However, while those are there, none of them are mandated. There's nothing requiring that the physician who, in order to become someone's attending physician, they have to see somebody once. There's no requirement that they've seen this person over any period of time. And with respect to any psychological evaluation, that's frankly not required. If the doctor who's seeing the person really concerned about somebody's mental health or their competency, then they do have the ability to refer them for mental health care. But they're not required to do so. And since these are people, these doctors, do not necessarily know the patient that's sitting in front of them, they don't know the history to know whether this is an appropriate request. So, for example, I'm a person who qualifies under this law, advanced neuromuscular disease. I rely on life support technology in order to live. I use a ventilator 24/7.
The reading of the Colorado proposal suggests that you have to be within 6 months of death, according to two physicians. Is that your case?
That's exactly my case, is that without this technology, I wouldn't have 6 months to live. I wouldn't have 6 weeks to live. I might, maybe, survive 6 hours. So I, like many people with disabilities, qualify under this law, which is part of what our concern is. This also looks at, you look at whether somebody has 6 months to live with or without treatment. So that could be every person who has type 1 diabetes in the state. If somebody has type 1 diabetes and does not get insulin, they will die within 6 months. So the definition for terminal is very broad. Plus, doctors make mistakes all the time. Doctors are not experts. They don't receive specific training in how to diagnose and life expectancy. Well, some particularly our oncologists would have experience, say, hey, look, when I see people with this type of cancer, I expect them to live this long or not live this long. But that's still not guaranteed. Definition saying only within 6 months is really meaningless. And it's evident in the Oregon statistics, which I really take offense at the idea that these are comprehensive statistics. There's very little data collected. None of the data is kept so that it could actually be studied. And the Colorado proposal does not require even a smidgen of the required of the statistics kept in Oregon. But even with the statistics that we have, we see people live for years after being after receiving a lethal dose. But for me, I'm a person who would qualify under this law. If I went to my doctor today and said, I'm tired of living life with a disability and I'm a smart person, I could lay out all the reasons that I know the biases that the medical profession has about people who live severely disabled lives. I could say all the right things. If my doctor's known me for a long time that I would say, no, I think you're depressed. You should get treatment. But this initiative would allow me to go to any other doctor.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guests are Carrie Ann Lucas. She's with the organization Not Dead Yet Colorado, or NO, on Proposition 106. Randy Lowenthal, who's a volunteer with the YES on Proposition 106, and Rabbi David Siegel of the Aspen Jewish Congregation.
This proposition, in my mind, really addresses a narrow set of circumstances, and it's all about personal choice. There are a whole list of things, including 18 years old, Colorado resident, mentally capable, physically capable, all those things that we don't even begin to have enough time to go through, which talks about leading up to being qualified for the personal choice. And that's my fear, if nothing else, is that some other person or organization or the state or federal government's going to step in and they're going to decide what's best for me. And one of the reasons that I support this as strongly as I do is that I really want to decide the level of comfort and quality of life for myself. I don't want somebody else to decide it.
I'd like to bring Rabbi David Siegel into the conversation. Just from that perspective, choice, and Carrie Ann, you said, I think, if you decided at some point that you were just tired of this life as it is today for you, or when someone has a diagnosis of 6 months, where does the faith community come down on that? It's one of the oldest taboos in the book to take a life. Yes?
Yes, and it's really, there's some big existential, moral, I mean, metaphysical even, questions that are in some ways extra legal, but do inform the conversation. I was thinking, as I was thinking about this conversation over the last few days, I was thinking about the idea that that our founding documents point us toward protecting life, liberty, and happiness, pursuit of happiness, and or that the government's job is to protect those things. This is a case where those are not necessarily in harmony. And so that's part of why it's very complicated. And so, of course, most faith communities would come down saying some version of life is sacred in all cases, at all times, period. And, of course, you hear echoes of the abortion debate in that. I don't want to even get into that because it is separate. We're dealing with, there's no argument about whether these are viable human beings in this case. So I'll leave that aside, although I know it's in the background for a lot of people. One of the questions is about how sacrosanct that value of life is, and that nothing should ever compromise that. You know, in Jewish bioethics, we're often talking about you're not required to prolong life artificially. In other words, terminal people can refuse treatment, but it's a harder sell to make the case for hastening death. The general consensus in our classical tradition, our literature, is to forbid that in all cases. But there's an element of like justice versus mercy here too that comes to mind for me.
Right.
So on the one hand, you can argue the legal side, but then when you're presented with a person who is suffering, that's what it's really about, I think, or supposed to be about, is reducing suffering. People who don't want to suffer at the end. Wherever we end up on the actual proposition, I do want to make a case for the role that hospice can play in these moments in life. We're blessed with a hospice of the valley here, and their job is to make one comfortable, as comfortable as possible, in those final days, weeks, months, you know, sometimes years. So, I mean, I'm not coming down on one side or the other exactly. I think certainly for more traditional, or I'll call quote-unquote Orthodox religious traditions, they would tend to line up on the side of opposing this proposition.
Carrie Ann, from the perspective of it being a merciful act, if it were to pass, what other safeguards in the law, if you could go back however long ago it was drafted, the language for the proposition, what would you have added to feel more comfortable with it?
I think there's a couple of several key safeguards that are missing. One of the things that's missing, and I want to reach this idea of hospice. I don't want Colorado to be known as a death state. We're already known as a marijuana state. I don't want us to be known as a death state. I want us to be known for good hospice and palliative care. And in this almost identical version of this measure was before the legislature last year in 2015 and again in 2016. And both times it failed. And each time during the testimony, many concerns were brought forth about problems with that people have receiving good palliative care. And unfortunately, this does nothing to improve palliative care. And in fact, in Oregon, Washington, measures of studies of palliative care have indicated that it actually declined. The quality of care has declined over the years rather than improved.
The hospice has increased.
In terms of the safeguards, a couple of things. One is there's no one present at the time of death. So this lethal drug is prescribed, dispensed by a pharmacy, and then brought home. There's no guarantee how that's handled in the home, but there's also no guarantee that someone hasn't changed their mind, but that a greedy heir or a family member or an upset caregiver doesn't want to hasten things along and put the pills in someone's applesauce and feed it to them. Because the cause of death is altered on the death certificate, there's not an opportunity for there to be a coroner investigation, that there's no witness at the time of death to help if there's a complication. We know there's been times in Oregon and Washington when the drugs did not work as intended and people had complications. And these are similar drugs as what are used for death penalty, to administer the death penalty. So we know there's complications when administering the death penalty when someone does not have the death that they had hoped someone would have. And there's also no witness to ensure that there's not any sort of malevolent kind of behavior on the part of somebody else around the individual. But we really view this from a social justice perspective. So while we, of course, value individual choice is not the end-all consideration. That we believe that because there's the lack of safeguards in terms of nobody being there at the time of death, there's allowed to be doctor shopping. If I want someone to sign a will, I'm not able to have my client would not have a valid will if I allow one of the beneficiaries for the will to be a witness to the will. But under this measure, a beneficiary to a will, someone who can benefit from the estate, can be one of the two witnesses who signs the consent paperwork for the lethal prescription. So there's a huge conflict of interest there. We know under the Oregon State Health Plan that the Medicaid now will tell people, no, we're not going to pay for this type of treatment, but instead we will pay for a lethal prescription. That becomes a level of financial coercion that just has no place in the laws of a civilized society.
Randy?
There are two witnesses that are required to when someone is in writing requesting this. And again, there's a process there where there is an oral request first, then wait 15 days, second oral request, and then there's a written request which has to be signed by two witnesses. There is absolutely control there. One of the people cannot be related or stand to gain financially. It can't be an employee of a health facility if the person happens to be resident at a facility, and it can't be the attending physician. So there has been thought given to this. There has been some modeling in comparison to the Oregon situation, and Oregon has no cases of abuse or misuse that have been reported since 1998. So
that's not correct. And partly because the statistics and the information collecting in Oregon is so poor, but the case of Thomas Middleton is a gentleman who had somebody who was a beneficiary of his estate sign his request.
Well, it
who
depends.
Was later convicted of stealing his estate, yet that person's involvement and that person's influence in his lethal prescription request in the case of Thomas Middleton.
There are people who will disagree with that, so let's not try to get into that. The attending and the consulting physicians go through a whole process with the person in counseling, in talking about making recommendations about having somebody who's, including family and or of a person of religious or faith orientation at the time when they are taking this medication. It is not required, you're correct, but it is strongly advised by the physicians, and it is something that is required to be advised. And there are a lot of those kinds of safeguards that you've really, I think you're misleading when you're describing some of these, and it would, again, take us an awfully long time to go through them one by one. And the one thing I really do want to say is that this is not considered assisted suicide, because suicide is not related to a terminal illness. So we're back to the terminal illness, which I think is something that, again, it's misleading in the conversation, that you are not going back to the terminal illness with 6 months in the diagnosis.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guests are Carrie Ann Lucas. She's with the organization Not Dead Yet Colorado, or NO, on Proposition 106. Randy Lowenthal, who's a volunteer with the YES on Proposition 106. And Rabbi David Siegel of the Aspen Jewish Congregation.
Was I correct in reading the statistics from Oregon, which flawed they may be, but I thought what I saw was that a majority of the deaths related to this act were, in fact, attended by either a hospice person or a physician.
As the state of Oregon will tell you, is that the enrollment in hospice has increased to more than 90% since this has been enacted. So just the fact that people are actually in hospice says that there will be people there and that there will be people assisting.
Right.
I think that's a myth. That's actually not correct. And unfortunately, so I'm a lawyer and my brain thinks like a lawyer, but so are others. There are hundreds of thousands of lawyers in Colorado and around the country who pick apart laws like this. And that's the problem with this law. So I understand that Randy wants to believe it says these things, but believes that the intention of this is such that it would not be misused. But we're talking about life and death. Mistakes will be made and people's lives will be lost from mistakes, coercion, and abuse as this law is written, because it has such inadequate safeguards. And just what I've described, she admits that these things are not required in the law. They're suggested. Well, suggested means it doesn't have to happen. So unless the law requires it to happen, and frankly, the idea of only one disinterested witness to end somebody's life, when you can have an interested witness, somebody who stands to benefit from the death of a person in their life, but we can't even have somebody with that level of involvement inherit mere money. So we value money over a life, which is of concern, because as a disabled person, I've seen my children's lives be devalued. For example, I have a 26-year-old who has multiple disabilities, who's otherwise very healthy, but very disabled. She went to Poudre Valley Hospital in Fort Collins to get some teeth pulled last year. Not an unusual procedure. She had to go to the hospital for it to be under anesthesia. Not unusual for young adults to have, for example, wisdom teeth pulled. She went there for that procedure. I was asked, does she have a do not resuscitate order? I responded, no, she doesn't. Do you want a do not resuscitate order? No, I don't want a do not resuscitate order on her. Well, are you sure you don't want a do not resuscitate order? Yes, I'm sure. Now I'm starting to be concerned, wondering what they're going to do with my then 24-year-old daughter. Because this is an example of how the medical profession devalues the lives of disabled people. When my other daughter went to get her wisdom teeth pulled under a very similar circumstances, who does not have any sort of physical or visible disability, I was never asked, not once, does she even have a do not resuscitate order? That's an example of how the medical profession devalues our lives. Because when physicians have been studied to evaluate the quality of life of disabled people, they consistently rate our quality of life lower than that we do. And that's a problem. And because this is not about individual choice. People have the choice now. People can take matters into their own hands now. This is getting the medical profession and the government involved in this.
Carrie Ann, I couldn't disagree more. I don't understand that at all, Carrie Ann. But it doesn't have anything to do with this proposition, Carrie Ann. You're distracting the conversation. This is not about DNR. This is about personal choice, and this is about Proposition 106.
That's going to be the last word on this, and I'm going to put the onus on our poor rabbi here to sort of give us a another view.
I'm zooming out a little bit to a bigger picture.
Yeah.
And a book recommendation, Being Mortal, by Atul Gawande. A problem that I think, well, Oregon maybe was ahead of the curve in the sense of facing what is becoming increasingly an issue that our medical apparatus is not equipped to handle, which is the increased number of people who will live into their 90s in this coming generation, and the number of, I guess you call them, degenerative diseases that we're going to probably inevitably see, whether it's cancer or other neurological diseases, in that aging population. And I don't know enough about the legal side to know if this proposition is the answer to some of that, but it is a problem that we as a society are not really looking at head on. And we tend to treat it with nursing homes, and they're not adequate either to the need that's going to arise. And hospice can handle some of this increased demand. But what I wonder about in this conversation, because it's certainly a bit of talking past, if there's a way to have the conversation about a terminal illness that can't be managed with technology versus a disability that someone can live with, however painful or difficult. On some level, no life is more dignified than another, right? They're all equal regardless of the level of ability. And that's where I think the religious community tends to come down on the side of never allowing artificial ending. But I do think a more productive conversation might be if we could pull out the disability question from the question of terminal illness. Because, you know, when Randy and I picture that situation, we're picturing someone who has late-stage cancer or advanced Alzheimer's. That's what I hear as a problem. And so as a pastor of a community, you know, my fear is, my anxiety is around more and more people facing this life moment, this kind of life situation. And that's not that there's a quick or easy answer regardless of whether this law passes or not, but I don't think we are equipped emotionally, socially, medically, even to face this trend.
It's a hard conversation to have, and I appreciate everyone's time.
And I think historically death has been a very difficult conversation. I know through the experiences that I have had, a lot of people don't want to talk about it.
Carrie Ann Lucas with Not Dead Yet Colorado, Randy Lowenthal, volunteer with YES on 106, the Colorado End of Life Options, Rabbi David Siegel, the Aspen Jewish Congregation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. If you missed the show or would like to hear it again, go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Have a great afternoon.